everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Polybites podcast, bringing you bite-sized politics. I am joined by Dean from Council Watch today, who's here to talk to us about what Council Watch does and some of the things that he is working on at the moment. Thank you for joining me, Dean.
My pleasure. Thanks, Emily, for having me.
Let's start off with a basic introduction. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and what your role is at Council Watch and how you became involved there.
Sure. So Council Watch has been representing ratepayers and residents and businesses across the state in all issues relating to councils, which are wide and varied, since about 2001. We were formerly Ratepayers Victoria, but Council Watch is now much more focused on being a people's watchdog, looking out for, helping and coordinating issues across the state and reporting the real truth on councils, the stuff they don't want you to know. My role is, like most people, I came to councils and councils as an issue probably about 6 or 7 years ago when my own local council sought to hurt me and my community by a dumb decision. That got a lot of people fired up and angry, and through a lot of local activism and advocacy, we realised that there was no one really taking on councils and keeping them accountable. And so, you know, got involved from that point of view. And funnily enough, now my partner and many of my friends are councillors on councils. and it's funny how things go. And I think every time councils see my name pop up in correspondence, they kind of go, oh, no, not him again. So, yeah, it's great fun. It's great fun.
Oh, good. Well, obviously, yeah, one of the reasons we got in touch to have you on the podcast is obviously I've seen your work around the place over the last couple of years, but more than that, you had a big, big splash about the piece you did on the CEO salaries that went crazy, obviously just because they're so exorbitant. And we're going to, I guess, as part of the podcast, go through some of the basics because not everyone is across councils and what they do, and then we'll go into some of the more detailed questions. But what are the main functions of Council Watch as you would describe them, and how are you funded, or are you just entirely voluntary?
Yeah, so we are entirely voluntary. Whilst we do have, you know, minimal funds to keep the lights on, we are an incorporated association and people can join and they can support us through an annual membership, which is, you know, $10 for a pensioner or a concession and $20 for an adult. So it's very cheap. We are looking at, you know, longer term, better funding mechanisms so that we can actually spend more time and resources professionally in the market. But essentially what our job is to keep councils honest. And the way we do that, we have two ways to do that. At a local level, we know that councils more than ever are emboldened by the fact that local media and local newspapers have essentially died, particularly in metropolitan Melbourne. And what we see is these local council stories that in the past would have been reported on and council would have been, you know, embarrassed if they got negative press. That really doesn't happen now unless it's of state significance to one of the majors. So we are currently working through raising up in Victoria, there are 79 councils. So we raise up 79 local community advocacy groups for Council Watch. One for each council. They tell the local stories to the local people. And then at a state level, what we do as Council Watch is we go out and do all of the investigation, pull in all the statewide information and actually give people a bit of a blanket understanding of what the industry is doing. And that CEO report you referred to is what we do at a state level, so that everybody can say, hey, what's my council CEO getting paid and what's the industry doing? What's the context? And our goal there is to actually pull that data into the public spotlight, because the one thing we know councils do so well is hide this information or not report it. And most people are just not aware of where their council is spending their money.
I think that the vast majority of people that are listening to this would wholeheartedly agree. I remember when I shared the salary piece on social media, the response from people was just absolute shock. They couldn't believe what they were being paid. I had lots and lots of questions. What do you mean we have a CEO? Why are they being paid so much? And full disclosure for the fact that maybe I need to do this, but the moment I saw that piece and went on the website and saw what you guys were doing, I instantly joined Council Watch. So I'm currently a member because I thought it was fantastic. And, you know, obviously having you on the podcast as well to help amplify some of the things that you're doing. In all of these discussions, we're sort of going around the basics, but I want to hear from you the basic functions of councils. What are councils actual responsibilities? And this actually came through as a question quite a bit from the audience, because people are getting a bit confused. Councils these days seem to be weighing in on everything from Australia Day to, you know, referendums to societal sort of social policy. What are councils' actual responsibilities?
Great question. So here's the answer that will shock most of your listeners. Councils, literally in the 2020 Local Government Act, their role was redefined. So what we know in the past is that council would do things like collect your rubbish, sweep the streets, you know, build lovely parks and gardens, provide libraries. Now they're still part of what council do. But in 2020, the Local Government Act redefined the local council to essentially say a council can do any and all things it deems necessary for the well-being and good governance of its municipality. Now, what that means is there is no definition in law for what a council can and cannot do. So I kid you not, if a council got a whack job idea of, hey, you know what, we want to send someone to the moon, they actually could do it. It's lawful, it's legal. And unless they break another law by something they do, they can legally do anything. And this is why we've seen such a hard push in councils into ideological and social issues that are not historically the role of councils. And really what we say at Council Watch is there is an ideological battle going on in councils at the moment for what is a council and what should it be doing. One example I'll give you that I'm sure some of your listeners have heard is that there was a particular council that only about a year or two ago decided to actually pass a motion to ban for the proliferation of nuclear disarmament. Now, that's a fantastic cause, but I don't know about you. My research has shown that there's not one council with nukes in a bunker somewhere.
Well, the council probably wouldn't know if there was, but yeah.
That's true. So it is just, you know, it is literally the Wild West. These guys can literally do whatever they like. And the problem in the legislation is that residents have no mechanism to say, we don't want you to do that. The only decision is what the councillors decide around that council chamber.
Yeah. This is fantastic explanation, by the way. I really appreciate it. And I think that goes to the heart of how many questions came in about, why is it the council suddenly talk about these things and do these things? Like, what's going on? And most of us would obviously have quite a decent memory for the fact that this was not normal, that, you know, 5-10 years ago, the idea of councils taking public position on federal policy was just unheard of. It would be bizarre. We obviously have the 2020 Local Government Act. That's a Victorian piece of legislation. The question I was going to ask you is, we seem to have a lot of issues with councils in Victoria specifically. Are we worse than other states for some reason? And it may be this Local Government Act. And if so, are we? And is that Government Act why?
Yeah, look, there are certainly elements that are consistent across the whole of Australia. And Council Watch's role is expanding from Victoria to Australia as we speak. What we see more than ever is that there are similar issues in other states and they need just as much help and unification and, you know, representation. So that's great. But Victoria has a unique set of problems. The Local Government Act 2020 is what we call a principles-based act. So when the government proposed the legislation change, instead of being really prescriptive around a council must do A, B, C, D, and you must do it this way, it decided to put up what's called a principles-based act, where it's you must show good governance by a policy, but no idea what that policy must and should cover. You must show public transparency by a public transparency policy. Well, that's not rocket science. Anyone would know that if you want to have public transparency, you'd have to have a policy of how you would do it. But if the government then didn't put in prescriptive regulations and conditions around what that should look like, it is literally 79 councils acting like the Wild West. And essentially, if they've got a policy and it says stupid things in that policy, it's still a policy and it meets the Act. What also happened was the penalties in the Act for councils not doing things have essentially been removed. So if a council is, if a council doesn't do something, at best, they probably get a slap on the wrist from the minister's department and told, put that policy in or fix that item up. And what's really disappointing is that then means that there's no performance requirement that actually then says, if your council didn't do this, they get a penalty, or the staff member gets, you know, the CEO gets held to account. So, you know, we have a system that really is not prescriptive. It's general themes only. And there's no penalty for failing to adhere to the principles that are in that act. It's completely not fit for purpose. It's one of the worst pieces of legislation we've seen. And one of the things that was really disappointing, we were consulted all along the way by the then local government minister, Natalie Hutchins, and then Adam Somurek. And Adam Somurek proposed on our recommendation to insert consumer, complaint mechanisms to be able to hold your council to account. And of course, all the councils hated that sort of metric. So they pushed back through the Municipal Association of Victoria. And lo and behold, we were not told until the final legislation hit Parliament for voting that all of the consumer protections that we had pushed into the Act were removed. So consumers now have a principles-based Act that they can't do anything about.
So 2 points that I want to get out of there. So Adam Somurek, I'm hilariously minister, prior to Excel, obviously, was actually in favour of adding in those consumer protections, and he helped you.
Absolutely.
Yep, great. Interesting point. And then secondarily, obviously, the councils, can't imagine why, advocated for them to be removed. So right now, councils have, and like, forgive me if this is a bit of a sloppy description, but they have no clear job description.
Right.
And there is no complaint mechanism to say you're not doing your job, which is impossible to say anyway because no one defined what the job is anymore. And we're basically paying an absurd amount of money in rates that is going up and up and up.
Yep.
For we don't actually know what because it's not defined and therefore there is nothing we can complain about anyway.
Correct. And just to pick up on that, you're 100% right. The local government industry in Victoria is $12 billion. That's a lot of money. So the income that councils receive in total in Victoria is $12 billion per annum. That money has no standards in the Local Government Act other than it should be spent, you know, in themes and general terms in a good way that's efficient. But there's nothing that says, here's what's right, here's what's wrong, here's what you can, here's what you cannot do. So, you know, if a council wanted to spend $20 million on legals, it could. Might not be the best thing, but it's allowed to. The second point to pick up on that is that not only can they do whatever they like, the Ombudsman, with a lot of help from us and others outside of councils, did a huge investigative report only a couple of years ago into council complaints, because the Ombudsman receives the most complaints, apart from the justice system, from local councils. And so the Ombudsman decided to do a report into, why am I getting all these complaints from, you know, councils that aren't resolving issues? And the Ombudsman found councils could not define a complaint, understand what was a complaint, prioritise complaints, or resolve the issues in any metric or time frame. So essentially, the Ombudsman said some councils thought a complaint was just somebody requesting for a service, so they just treated it like someone asking for a service request, not a complaint. And the Ombudsman also found that the Local Government Act had no mechanism for anyone to take a complaint to anywhere but the actual council you were complaining about. So if the council refused to answer your complaint, you're at a dead end. So we have a $12 billion industry that has no accountability. What the hell is going on in our councils?
I think you can probably hear me throughout this interview just laughing a little bit, because at some point you have to just, like, you either laugh or you'll scream.
Correct.
This is something, obviously, that is not entirely unique to Victoria as a problem. However, it is clear that it is exacerbated immensely here. And this is probably a bit of a redundant question at this point, because we've kind of loosely said it, but just to get it on the record.
Yeah.
Do all rates that we pay go directly to just that council? And why, in theory, do we pay rates?
So, essentially, councils would probably prefer us to not call it a rate. They would prefer it to be known as a property tax. But the truth is, it's a rate. It's a form of a property tax based on the value of your property. A couple of key things. A lot of people ask about, you know, well, how do I know why the value is the value it is? The state government changed the Valuation of Land Act a couple of years ago and took it off councils. And they actually made it a state requirement. And the requirement of valuing your property before your rates notice is issued is now every year, and it's at the property's best and highest use. And so there are a lot of people who are sitting on properties that could be developed that might be worth 3 or 4 times what it really is worth if they sold it to another person, and they're paying rates on that, number one. So there's no equity in the calculation method. But what we are essentially paying rates for is, unfortunately, it's not, you know, for libraries, for clean streets and rubbish collection, although that's part of what we do. We're paying, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in our local council usually to the council for it to spend however it kind of likes. And in all honesty, whilst people think the council is sitting around that table, have got their handle on, you know, exactly where every dollar is going, the truth of the matter is the councillors vote on a high-level budget in a set of numbers, mm-hmm. and the executives make all the decisions under delegation as to where that money is going to be spent, apart from, you know, really large contracts or projects like a $20 million or a $40 million item, which the council would vote on. Most council CEOs and the staff underneath have delegations of $1 or $2 million, which means they can spend any of that money in the budget in any particular way if they deem it's necessary to complete what the business needs to do. Now, of course, the direction of council is set by councillors, but the spending decisions are made by officers, and there is not much at all public transparency around what those decisions are, except in the group financial reports at the end of the year in a high-level collective number. So, it's, you know, your answer to that question is they could spend on anything they like. We saw, Emily, only recently, each year, the Australian Local Government Association, ALGA as it's known, runs a national conference. A couple of weekends ago, that happened for a few days, and what we saw across Victoria and, in fact, all of Australia was millions of dollars spent sending CEOs and councillors from over 600 councils, about 600 councils, across the country to a conference in Canberra to effectively lobby, allegedly, federal politicians who don't care about local government. Local government is constituted at a state level. It's a state government you need to talk to. But here we were seeing councils spend millions of dollars collectively sending everyone on a junket to Canberra to have a party and a good time. That's fine. Okay. But on ratepayers' money.
Yep. Which is,
that's,
you know,
the kind of stuff. Yeah.
I mean, we saw Sally Capp go on a junket to, I think it was Singapore, to work
South
out
America.
Less graffiti or something, which cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, which is obviously completely irrelevant to everything and a total waste of money. To go really briefly back to the comments we were talking about the rates and how they're calculated about the land value, this is something that I have spoken very extensively to business owners about in particular, obviously homeowners as well. Obviously, best and highest use value is farcical. It has caused a massive increase in land tax. It's one of the reasons why our property market in Victoria is actually so much more expensive. It's been a massive contributor to that. And I think what I really want to highlight out of this is if your rates are based on the best and highest use and your land tax is based on best and highest use, and they are two separate taxes on the same piece of land to the same individuals, but at the highest rate possible, that is a compounding problem. And this is what came through in a couple of different questions, which you can always tell the people that have paid rates. They're going, isn't rates land tax twice? And essentially, the answer is yes.
Yes, correct. And your rates are just going to the council to pay for their organisation running and the things that they choose to do, whereas the land tax is going to the state government to prop up their finances. So, you know, we sit there saying, come on, you really shouldn't have both. It's either or. You can't have both.
Yep. Well, I mean, they're trying.
I think it's only going to get worse.
Yeah. So, obviously, as cost of living pressures are coming in, these sorts of things really kind of come to the fore, as well as levels of service that people are receiving, because we're seeing some councils somehow increase their rates and add extra fees like bin collection fees. They're reducing how often bins get collected. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with, I mean, in your perspective, a lot of the stuff that's coming out in the media at the moment, you know, all these different councils, like I think it was Yarra, for example, is adding an extra a bin collection fee to residents or something like that, which you would have thought as a basic function is what the bottom line should be going to first. And people are getting very annoyed about that. But what's going on there? Like, is this just councils have gone so wild west with all of their spending and all of their salaries and everything that they just don't care and they're just adding fees on? Is that...
Yeah, essentially what's happened is, so for a really very quick backstory about rate capping, everyone in Victoria would probably know that each year the state government through the Essential Services Commission sets what councils are allowed to go up at a maximum level in their rates. Now, that doesn't include fees and charges, because a council can set any fees and charges for other things it likes. And that's where you see a lot of increases, you know, parking fines going up from, you know, say maybe $80 to $150 or $200 generates a huge windfall. Aside from the user fees and charges, when it comes to rates and the rate cap, it was actually some of our founding members of Ratepayers Victoria who lobbied to have the Central Services Commission rate cap in 2016, and it was brought in by the government. The councils have absolutely been on the warpath about this for years, because it's the first time they were constrained in the income they could generate by rate rises.
Yep.
They wanted abolished. So the first thing they did was lobby the state government and work out that they could actually separate out particular functions. And when the state government said, we want all councils to go to the same colour bins and the mandatory kind of system for FOGO, they said, well, we can't afford all of that infrastructure. Understandably, you know, that's a quite large infrastructure to replace trucks and bins and lids and all those things across all councils. So they lobbied and were able to collectively get agreement that they could separate out the bin charge and exempt it from rate capping. And what that meant was they could now say, we've separated out the direct cost of that service, collecting your bin and your recycling, and no matter what it does, if it goes up from our supplier 30% a year, your charge will go up 30% a year. And it separates it out, and then they can say, we're now not having to actually absorb cost increases in the rest of our budget. Yay, we're happy. What people don't like hearing is that that means that the council can go and buy new infrastructure as often as it likes and just charge it back through that direct mechanism. So it's really the council themselves doing what they accuse the state of, which is the state government's always pushing costs out to councils. So, for example, you know, three-year-old kinder was all of a sudden announced as a new thing councils would do, and they're wondering where they're going to get the funding. Well, the state government's just pushed that onto them and hasn't necessarily given them the money to do it, so they've got to figure out how they do that. What the councils are now doing is, well, if it's good for you, we'll separate out this charge and cost shift it to the consumer directly. And what we are hearing is there's a lot more pressure, Emily, on the state government to allow councils to pull individual services out, just like they have with the waste levies and bin taxes, and push them outside the rate cap to, you know, generally get all of their income up as much as they can. Now, some of this is happening because they're trying to be all things to everyone and, you know, nothing great in particular. And some of it is the cost pressures of councils just trying to do everything it can because they're somehow wanting to be, you know, the United Nations and solve world peace at the same time. Not in their remit, but because they don't have a definition, they can. So that's a huge issue that, you know, when you don't have a definition, you can kind of play in any pool and put money anywhere. The problem that we have is that it's causing huge inequity on people. And one thing that I really want your listeners to understand is that a couple of years ago, we worked extensively with the Ombudsman through COVID around hardship provisions. What councils have in the Local Government Act is a requirement to consider anyone in hardship and consider waiving some or all of their rates if they're in extreme hardship. Now, hardship might be you literally are struggling to eat. You're struggling to, you know, keep the roof over your head. And what councils have been shown to do by the Ombudsman 2 years ago was literally not provide any hardship to anyone. They don't give anyone any help. They just defer the payment. Now, what we saw was older persons who might have, you know, $40,000, $50,000 worth of rates debt and they can't pay it because they don't have income. We saw them just adding this on to their property when it's sold and claiming off, you know, dead people this kind of money. And the Ombudsman issued a scathing report into the way councils use lawyers and threaten people in these situations. We've actually just done an FOI program across all councils as the cost of living crisis is getting worse. And Emily, we've had about half of the councils in Victoria write back to us with these numbers so far. And out of about 30, 35 councils that have told us in the last 2 years how much money they've given back to ratepayers in hardship, one council has given $12,000 back. So what we want listeners to understand is that councils continue to behave worse than a predatory bank, worse than a predatory utility company, who actually have really good social policy around helping people when they are in trouble. Councils' attitude is, if I give anyone $1, I have to give everyone $1. And I kid you not, a former mayor of the city of Maribyrnong had this to say about people who apply for hardship. Why would I give someone in hardship $1 off their rates when they might win Tats Lotto tomorrow and I would have wasted money helping them. This is a cultural problem we have in councils of protect the income at all costs, no matter the social impact. And it's why I get up every day and why our team at Council Watch exists. We cannot treat human beings in this manner. When people are in severe financial crisis, we have to help them.
That is just disgusting. And I think that there are so many people who are listening to this who would have had difficulties with their councils.
Yeah.
Or just whatever experience it is. I mean, my first experience ever working in any government department was in a local council, and I found it so, how do I put this? It was so bad, I swore I would never, ever work in any government department ever again. It was that bad from what I saw. But this is something I think that I'm so glad we're doing this episode. I think this is something that people really, really need to hear and be aware of. And we're talking about how just inhumane and awful these councils are being. This is obviously not unique to one council. Dozens and dozens are like this. And we mentioned the big piece before you did about salaries. This is something that has really upset a lot of people. It came out last week that the City of Melbourne has appointed their new CEO. She was the interim CEO anyway, whatever. Her salary is over $500,000 a year. How are council salaries so high? Like, what is going on? How is it possible that there is a justification to pay a council CEO or even some of these councillors some of these salary amounts? And I mean, we've sort of touched on the fact that there's basically no guidance at all about what councils are even meant to do or complaints processes. But are there like at least individual KPIs of some kind?
So to answer your first question around how do they get these salaries? So, you know, I want to speak really respectfully around councillors. Councillors are fed information and told information, and most of the time they have to trust that the information they're getting from officers is correct. When it comes to, and you know, I've probably got a lot to say about that in another episode, or I could talk about the misinformation or lack of information that's actually given to councillors that would sometimes change decisions. But when it comes to hiring a CEO, which is the only staff member that councillors collectively hire, they do need help. So what they do is they go to a series of employment consultants. And the problem that we have in the hiring process of CEOs, which is creating this really high level of salary, is that there is only a couple of providers that actually specialise in council CEO recruitment. Now, those advisors have a view, and the industry has a view, that you can't really run a council if you haven't worked in a council. So there is this insular attitude that says the public, you know, the private sector, sorry, the employee out there that could have been a CEO in another company is at a disadvantage to ever break into the system. Now, what that means is that the majority of people and talent that's coming up as CEOs have been conditioned for 10, 20, 30 years in a culture that you just referred to before. What that means is they know that there are very little performance metrics. There's no public performance metrics that the CEO has to put on display. And really the measure of most councillors' satisfaction is how they feel about the CEO. Oh. So it becomes a much more political role about appeasing, you know, the majority of councillors, or in some cases a ruling faction, and keeping them on board so you keep your job. Now, what that does is it doesn't serve the public interest. It serves personal interest. And so we see, with the greatest respect to some great CEOs out there, there are some, but we see this rusted on culture that recycles CEOs across the network, and everyone is just trying to get more money. So the move to a council from one, you know, smaller regional council to a larger council is always about bigger money and bigger things. Why council CEOs move? Funnily enough, the motivator is obviously the money and the prestige, but it's also an unspoken pipeline of projects. So what council CEOs often ask is, what are you building? Because I want on my resume these big projects, because these big projects are what give me leverage to go outside the industry into some big government or, you know, private industry executive role worth millions of dollars eventually. And so the problem that we have there is, the entire reason that these salaries are being paid is because they have a small pool of candidates being recycled, We have a very small pool of consultants saying this is what you need to pay, and we have council CEOs that they're actually interested in the money and the pipeline of build. Now, that's not how you would hire someone commercially in, you know, in any sort of private business.
No, I, it's also, this is slightly anecdotal, but, and you will be able to attest to this as well. There is something about working in the public service, and it's so strange. You basically have to have worked in it to get another job. Once you're in for life.
Correct.
And, you know, you go for a job, say, for example, in state government, and the question that they will ask you is, have you ever worked in a government department before? They don't care what it is. They don't care where it is. They frankly don't care what you did. And I can attest to that.
Yeah,
they'll hire you on that basis. It's once you've broken in, you're in for life.
You're in, correct.
Getting in, if you have no experience, is disproportionately difficult. And whether it's intentional or not, there is this widely accepted and perpetrated culture that you hire for government people who've already worked in government. And it's actually quite difficult in some areas to break into that industry. And that was further made difficult by the government's reduced use of contractors over time, where it would actually bring in people from the outside who didn't have government experience, give them some, and then they could be employed full time. Often when you have people applying for government roles, there were legislative changes that essentially meant that governments, state departments, and I believe councils as well, must try and hire internally first. And only if that fails, only and when if that fails, do they apply for permission to be able to hire externally. And it's just encouraged that perpetuation of recycling candidates and people who, quite frankly, sometimes are just not that good. They should probably be fired, but performance management is a massive problem in the public service, or the lack of it. And we get this sort of very toxic cycle with people going into roles that, frankly, you know, if you put it out to the public, or it was genuinely a KPI linked, performance based, are you the best person for the job overall out of all of society, then perhaps things would look very different. I guess we sort of went through, you know, a brief descriptor of how these salaries have gotten to this point. Obviously, there is a level of prestige attached to, depending on the different councils and so on.
And Emily, it's headcount. It's headcount as well. So one of the key arguments is just because the council has this many staff, that puts the salary higher. That's not any, you know, that's not an item in isolation that should ever be used.
Yeah. Oh, that makes no sense whatsoever. So that's... Let's go on to a couple of things. I realize we're getting on in time now. So people obviously had a chance to submit questions to the podcast. There was an incredible amount of responses naming councils who they thought were doing the wrong thing in some capacity, which I'm sure you get a lot of. At the moment, obviously, we've spoken about the fact that there's not really a mechanism for it. But if people do have a complaint or a problem or a concern about their council, what can they do at the moment about it?
Yes.
What is there?
So of course, first thing, you have a problem with your council or you want to raise a complaint, you must start with the council. Even though that might sound, you know, a bit silly, you actually have to start with them and say to them, I'm formally, and you've actually got to spell it out so they're very clear, it's a complaint. I'm formally complaining, I'm not happy, and I'd like an answer. You must go through their initial complaint assessment and an outcome. You know, if it's been a month and you haven't heard something, you know, that might be indicative that they may not remember you or they've forgotten, but certainly until it's been a reasonable amount of time or they've given you an outcome that's unsatisfactory, you have to deal with them in the first instance. At that point, if you're not happy, you can go to the ombudsman, and the ombudsman, whilst they don't have power to compel, the ombudsman can certainly look into whether the response to your complaint was adequate.
Yep.
And if it's not adequate, the ombudsman will write back to council and say, we're not happy with what you've done and we want you to consider XYZ ABC. Now, that does help. Councils don't like getting stuff from the ombudsman. So if it's a service complaint, follow that process. What we also do is we track complaints for people. So they can go to our councilwatch.com.au website. Mm-hmm. And if they're frustrated with their council, log the complaint through us. Yep. If it hasn't gone to council, we'll run it back through council. If not, we'll run it to the ombudsman. And the goal there is to ensure that we start getting some visibility to what sorts of complaints are happening on a statewide basis, because councils don't report at all on complaints. And so it's this bottomless pit. In the first instance, complain to your council, escalate it to the ombudsman, come to us if you need help.
So this is a bit of a side question from what you've just mentioned. What do councils report on?
So they report on finance and progress on policy and stuff like that. But they're not actually required, and we would certainly like it to change. They're not required to report on complaints. And I don't know about you, but I've been in business and around a lot of business for my entire life. The best data any CEO and executive team can ever use to work out how to make people happier from a service standard is your complaints data. So if the councils don't even know what that is and don't even know how to analyze it, we've got a huge problem. They wouldn't know what we want.
Yep, that's a really, really good point. A couple of final questions. This one was submitted. We sort of touched on it before, but I know that there's quite a few people who want to know. You spoke about the increase of parking fines by councils, because obviously it's a massive revenue raiser. Someone put in the question, I thought it was a really, really good question, is why are parking fines the amount that they are? How do they decide how much they are?
So this is a really funny question, because there probably used to be some science that it was around, penalty units, based on the state government published penalty unit, which gets updated each year. And some are still kind of linked to that. But the vast majority are, how much do we need out of parking fines? And let's work backwards to how many fines we expect to get. And what we've actually seen, for example, is, believe it or not, one of the biggest losses of income councils have had has been parking fines due to COVID change behaviour in the way we work, shop, et cetera. We're much more local. So they're seeing a decrease in the number of fines that they can rely on because it's gone down. So we've also seen then the counter move of councils to go, well, I need to jack the fines up by 30% to cover the 30% that I'm losing. So it is really always the budget and the revenue that sets everything else.
Right, there's going to be a lot of people who currently
It's nuts.
Who are not happy to hear this. And again, this is just a circumstance where if a council decides that something that was a fine 2 weeks ago that was $100 is now $130, there's nothing you can really do to complain about it.
No. I mean, you can always say to the council, is it a reasonable fine? You can challenge the premise of, is the fine really recovering the charge that it's, or the inconvenience it's causing council? You could probably mount a good argument around that, but you'll certainly spend more than the fine on a lawyer challenging council who, for the purpose, would probably be happy to spend $100,000 to beat you because they don't want a precedent.
Nothing like state-sanctioned bullying. I'm gonna end this on the question that I have been personally sort of thinking about over the last couple of months in particular, and with more and more media coming out about some of the more outrageous things that councils are doing and charging and saying, would you, I guess, and you can differentiate this between Council Watch's position and your position individually, would you be in favour of abolishing councils and putting the responsibilities into a state department, for example, or in some way kind of, I guess, just destructuring what exists right now in councils?
Yeah, so in our view, the long-term so the Council Watch view, and certainly my own personal view, aligns on this as well. Long-term, you can't really have both, particularly when you've got local government with such an open-ended mandate, and the state's probably got more definition than local government. There's so much duplication, and whilst councils complain all the time about cost shifting, they equally love the cost shifting because it makes them more relevant, that they're getting more decisions and more money and more this and more that. So, in the short term, we want councils defined so that we actually get rid of a lot of the duplication and we get really clear. In the long term, we want councils or the state abolished and disbanded. Now, one way you can achieve that is you can actually define councils first, what they can and can't do, and then you can actually work to push councils back into the state government as a department of the state and overseen just like any other ministerial portfolio rather than 79 little kingdoms.
Yeah, 79 little kingdoms that comprise of a $12 billion income. And I mean, look, don't get me wrong, governments are far from the most efficient thing known to mankind, particularly state government departments, but $12 billion for libraries, bins and parks seems like a pretty decent budget to be able to get it done without having to pay individuals $500,000 salary to have essentially no KPI.
Absolutely. There's so much so much money in the system that could be saved by somebody creating a better, more efficient, prescriptive system.
Yep. Well, I mean, it's also a question about what it would do to reduce the cost of housing and rents in the state if you were to basically stop double taxing land. We've got land tax and we've got the rates. If you were to only have one, I mean, that makes a massive difference.
Imagine what it would look like if everyone who's got a rates bill or even is a renter that's getting their rent pushed up because of rates, right? You know, rate rises and rate bills. Imagine if we could tomorrow say, hey, we've got a mechanism that could take 30 to 40% minimum off your rates bill if we incorporated it back into the state and made it run like a proper department. I don't think there's anyone in Victoria who wouldn't sign up for that.
No, I can't imagine there would be. Oh, sorry, I take that back. Other than the councillors. Other than the people enjoying the paychecks that come from the rates results.
And just funny on that, the councillor's role is to represent, you know, what's in the best interest of their municipal community. So if they were half decent, they'd actually agree that them and me being out of a job in this stuff would be a good thing.
And yet somehow I feel like that's probably not going to be how they react to that campaign. But
too many political ambitions.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I look forward as a NOW member to following Council Watch's work over the coming months and years with great interest. I'll certainly continue talking about it. Really appreciate your time here today. And yeah, we'll stay in touch.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much to all of your listeners for listening.